as much as I say I accept myself now, there's some part of it that still struggles. With gay men, we have to live with the fact that not everyone likes us. People are always going to discriminate against us regardless of what we do.
Whether it's the clothes you wear to work or a metaphor for putting up a front, we all wear a uniform. But often there's a lot going on behind the uniform, and many of us are reluctant to express how we are really feeling.
Each week on Behind the Uniform, Dr. Izzy Smith and Captain Hugo Tovey will be joined by a special guest as they talk openly and honestly about their experiences with mental health. Nothing will be off limits, so prepare yourself for tears, laughter and goosebumps.
Hello everybody and welcome back to episode 8 of Behind the Uniform. We're ticking along the episodes and can't believe we're already at episode 8, but as always we've got a pretty inspiring guest with us today. And Izzy, it's always great seeing your smiley face. How are you today?
I am good. I'm pretty excited that the borders with Melbourne are starting to open up and, you know, you're going back to Adelaide after this today. I'm jealous that you're getting to go home and see loved ones. But I feel that's really picked up my mood in the last kind of week or two that, fingers crossed, a little bit of normality is coming back.
I know. It feels that shift. Well, at least obviously in Australia, which we're fortunate about, and being in Sydney, I'm fortunate about. But I'm pretty happy to head back home to Adelaide and see my family and my friends. I feel like it's been forever. We're actually talking off mic about it. It's strange checking on the plane, you know, online, and actually going to an airport just seems so foreign. So
you fancy bugger, you're going on Qantas.
Well, I didn't have much choice. Like, there's actually not heaps of flights at this time, so I prioritised this podcast episode, and then I'll head off to the airport and happy days. But look, really looking forward to today.
Yeah, so am I. We have a guest that I'm really excited about. His name is Simon Dunn. He is a rugby player turned Australian bobsled athlete. He's trained at the Canadian Institute of Sport. He's also a very proud member of the LGBTQTI community and was the first openly gay bobsled athlete to represent his country. He's an ambassador for the Bobby Smith Foundation, which supports people living with HIV. And relevant to this podcast and what, you know, these conversations are all about, he's had struggles with his mental health, which is, you know, very sadly is very common in the gay community, but not spoken about enough. But he's now living in Sydney, back playing sport, doing heaps of awesome charity and ambassador work. And as we discovered before, also a swimmer, because I could recognise his tattoos when I've seen him at the pool. So next time, rather than, you know, check out your tattoos, I'll say, hey, Simon, how you going?
Oh, that's quite the introduction, and thank you for having me. As you mentioned, I believe this podcast is really important, and with my own issues with mental health and everything that I do, it's the honour's mine to be here.
No, love having you, Simon, and we're really looking forward to delving into some pretty important topics and hearing what you have to say about all sorts of stuff. But it's and maybe learn a bit more about bobsledding.
it's a sport not many Australians know anything about besides Cool Runnings.
I was going to say, do you cringe every time people mention Cool Runnings when you say you're a bobsledder?
It's similar to the O word we mentioned earlier. It happens every single day.
Mate, I saw a good photo of you and your Lycra though, rocking the bobsledding outfit.
That's the main part of bobsledding, isn't it? It's not funny in minus 30 though, because they actually don't cancel bobsled until it's minus 30. So it'll be minus 29, you're in Lycra, and you're just like, what the hell am I doing here?
Well, look, before we do get into a bit of the bobsledding and also a bit of your rugby journey and also your story as a whole, just wanted to ask you, and it's something we like to have a little recurring question for our guest, is when you are your happiest, mm-hmm. when you're your happiest, what are you doing and who are you with?
So generally me, to be in my happiest, I am with family. Probably on a beach somewhere, just relaxing, because pretty close with my niece and nephews. They're very important to me, and so spending time with them is probably what makes me the happiest.
Do you know what's interesting with that question is, and hearing Simon's response about family and, you know, being with his niece and nephew and being with loved ones, is that I don't think we've had a guest so far, anyone say something that involves significant amounts of money or, you know, driving their nice car or whatever.
Don't get me wrong, I wouldn't. I'm not against that idea. I'm totally cool to hang around with my niece and nephews in my Lamborghini.
But you know what I mean? The first thing is usually, it's usually things that don't cost heaps of money. It's your friends, family, you know, dogs going
just
for a walk.
Things that make you content. And
I know for me with COVID, what I have missed of anything is my nephew. Mm. Like, you know, I love going out to nice bars and Bondi, dancing, all of that stuff. But fuck, I just want to hear my like nephew's giggles and cuddles, and that is what I'm hanging out for the most.
Yeah, he's very cute as well. You always show me like a proud auntie, always his little photos and what he's been up to, which I love.
I'm an obnoxious aunt. I'm sorry.
I'm like that with my dog. Show everyone my little dog. But
oh, it's kind of the same.
Exactly.
Now, talking of, you know, children, we'll learn a bit more about you, Simon, and I want to know about your childhood, where you grew up. We know rugby was, you know, very important to you, but can you tell us a bit about your childhood, your family? Yeah.
Indeed, I can. So I was born in Goulburn. It's a little sheep town in...
Are you about to say a shithole?
Yeah. I wouldn't call it that because my family still lived there. But
sorry, I saw you like stutter on the shit word.
Sheep. So it's a sheep town in like New South Wales. From there, we moved a lot because I grew up in a single mother home. But majority of my childhood was spent in Wollongong, just south of Sydney. It's kind of like a beach town, industrial.
What happened with your dad?
Just when I was basically six months old, my parents separated. And we had a very distant relationship until I was about 24, but still.
That's a big gap.
It is a big gap, and that's part of the reason why I don't think we've really ever fixed that relationship. For me as a child, I don't feel like that I should be the one trying to mend that relationship.
And you shouldn't be.
So that for me is, it's not been a priority for me. I have my own life now. I've got my own family who have time for me. So that's one of the reasons why it's not something that bothers me because it's something I've never placed too much importance on.
But then growing up, I suppose, now you can obviously see that. But yeah. Say when you're growing up and, you know, your friends or people that you're around typically had, a father in their life or a father figure. Was that difficult growing up?
Especially because I was heavily involved in sport. So I've played rugby league since I was four. So I would always have my teammates training with their dads and stuff, and that's something that I could never do. My mum wouldn't have been able to. She's useless when it comes to anything physical literacy or sport-wise. So I'd see, my friends training with their dad, and that did have an effect on me. But as a child, if it's what you've always known, it's normal. So it didn't place too much emphasis on that.
I think for me, of someone who's grown up without a dad, it was almost more as an adult looking back as a child and thinking about what I missed out because, you know, at the time it was normal. But now, you know, I was very, very sporty and my dad was sporty and that's where I got it from. And I was sad that I didn't get to have him there and share it. But, yeah, it wasn't till an adult that I really learned about how much I kind of missed out on.
Yeah, I do see some of the relationships that some of my friends have or with their fathers and actually having a relationship in general. It's like I would have had liked that. But it also has created the person I am now as an adult. That's why I have so much time for my niece and nephews, because I want them to have strong parental figures, which is something I necessarily didn't have growing up.
And do you, looking forward on that, do you want to be a father yourself one day?
One day. I'm not in a rush, even though I'm 33 and...
Mate.
I'm 30 and I'm not in a rush. Right. Don't say that.
My partner keeps giving me hints and trying to rush me, but no rush.
Well, I don't want to be one of those people that have kids young either. So I always joke to Felix, my partner, he also wants children. I'm like, I even want them between the ages of 35 or 40. If I don't get them, I'll just go on a holiday and buy a yacht or, with my disposable income, use it for something fun.
I thought you were going to say, buy a child. I was like, well, I don't know if this is really ethical.
So during those, you said you're growing up without that sort of father figure and you're into sport at a pretty young age. So I understand basically since, the age of four?
Correct,
basically,
yeah.
You've had a rugby ball in hand and...
Yeah, growing up, I didn't know there was any other sport besides rugby league. So I started when I was four in under sevens, which... I was a short, fat kid with blonde hair, which might surprise you now, because I was so little and just fat, I'd just growl at people. And that was my tactic to get past them because seven-year-old kids were like, oh shit, this kid's got problems.
You don't use that tactic anymore?
No, it's generally swearing, but I've learned to use my words.
So I'm remembering this TV show of American football and they put these foaming things in their mouth. Was it little rascals or something like that? Anyway, I'm just visualising this little child growling at people and laughing. So rugby was really important to you and I think sport is such a protective, important thing for people's mental health and that's been a bit of a theme in the podcast. You are gay and... rugby is one of the most masculine, macho kind of sports. It's got a reputation of doing some pretty terrible things to women. I think they're trying to change that culture. How is that for you, having, rugby being your biggest passion and then being a young gay guy?
So for me, it was very tough. So I got to the point where I was playing 2 or 3 games a week. So I was playing for the school, club rugby and so forth. And then I kind of started to realise that I was different to all the other guys in my team from about the age of 12. And it's something that took me a while to accept. But you also realise that, as you mentioned, rugby is not a welcoming place for anyone who's different. On the field, if someone wants to plays badly or poorly, they're either a poof or a fag. And as a 16-year-old, or from the age of, like I said, 12 to 16, these were things that every time I'd hear that would actually, you take it personally. And in that also makes it harder for me over time to accept who I was, and kind of would have added to the mental health and struggle as a teenager, like most teenagers do.
So when you saying that, so when did you first think that you were a gay, or when you had those thoughts?
Looking back, from about the age of 12, I probably fully accepted it 14, 15 when I started to tell other people, and then I came out when I was 16. But it's something that you try and, as a gay teenager, you try and put it off as long as you, like, you try to deny it, think of an excuse just to avoid.
Is that a typical, like, when you know you've spoken since obviously then, and you've no doubt got many gay friends, and you know, my uncle's gay, I've got plenty of gay mates myself, but when is that, what is like, what age do typically people think, or they go, yep, I'm gay? Like, is it the same age roughly?
It's generally about around the puberty time.
Yeah. So as soon as you hit puberty, kind of thing.
Yeah, things are a little bit different.
Different.
And different's a terrible word to say, but it's just not what all your friends are feeling. And that's generally when I started to accept it. And it took me a long time of every day. Like, I'm not even a religious person, but I'd pray just not to be gay every single night.
That's heartbreaking.
365 times a year, and it doesn't work. You know that this is who I am. It's not going to change. But then you've got to realise, now that I've convinced myself, I've got to in turn now convince everybody else and tell everybody else and go through that process over and over again.
And for gay people, there's actually, before they've even come out, so much trauma that they've dealt with, because for years they've had this, you know, internal struggle. So not only when they come out, and if there's, you know, it's not supported, and I know in the rugby world you had, you know, quite a lot of homophobia and abuse, but before that's even started, people have been through so much, just, you know, you know, being something and having to present something different to the world. And you can understand why, you know, being gay is such a recipe for mental health, because it's, you know, so much, you know, the tip of the iceberg, I think, is, you know, they're telling people and it coming out.
Well, it's statistically proven that gays, are, especially gay teenagers, are more likely to commit suicide, more likely to have mental health issues, and also more likely to do drugs. And that's just, I think that is from the recipe of having to deal with your own struggle to accept yourself and then have others accept you. A lot of us are shunned from our friends and family. I lost some friends who I'd been friends with for my entire life playing rugby, and as you get older, you realise that those people weren't friends. Sorry. But at the time, you feel like your world has fallen apart.
Especially when you're young.
Sorry.
When you're young, it's very normal to just desperately want to be accepted by your peers and feel validated and feel part of something. I think as we grow older, you know, into our late 20s, early 30s, we grow into ourselves and we're more self-assured. But, you know, adolescence is a hard time, even if you're not gay.
Yeah, definitely. I know with me, I remember one example is, I used to walk home with one of my rugby mates every single day from school. This was probably for like 4 or 5 years. And when I came out, he no longer wanted to walk home with me. sorry, I'm coughing, not crying. He no longer wanted to walk home with me, and it wasn't that he wasn't my friend anymore. He just didn't want other people to see him with me.
And when you talk about the acceptance side of things, Simon, when do you, you know, when do you think you were at peace or at full acceptance with your sexuality? Where you thought that, you know, I'm at peace for.
To be brutally honest, it wasn't until I was about 24. It's something that I struggled with. I've written and spoken before about leaving sport from 18 to 24, and it wasn't until I had found other like-minded gay men, got back into rugby, that I fully accepted and was happy with my sexuality. Now I see it as a gift. I wouldn't change it for the world, where it was something, as I mentioned earlier, that I prayed for every single day to go away. now, from the age of 24 to now, I wouldn't do anything to keep it.
I love hearing
who I am, and I'm very proud of it.
And I love that, and so you should be. And you've done some amazing things as an athlete, and what you've accomplished. I think you should be proud of who you are and what you've accomplished. But sort of looking at that time, we talk about those vulnerable years, and when you first came out at 16, who did you first come out to, and what was that like coming out, and how did your, say, family and friends first react to that?
So the first person I came out to would have been about 14, 15. She was my best friend. She was a little Lebanese girl. And I remember she was fine with it. She was always my cover girl during school, because I played rugby and stuff, and other girls would like me, but would always say that I was going to date her, but because she had Lebanese parents. That went on for years. And I actually remember the day I came out, everybody at 16, I was worried that her dad was going to be a bit...
Oh, was he relieved? He's like, oh, good, she's not going to go for my daughter.
He invited me in for dinner and everything. He was
like, so cute.
This old Lebanese guy you'd expect, really religious, and he was so welcoming. And I think it was just because he's like, you're not going to marry my daughter, thank God. But I fully came out when I was 16. That was at a party drunk. So, like most rugby teenagers.
I heard that when you told your mum, she wasn't very supportive initially. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, so it happened in an argument, which was probably not the best time to tell her. And I was a trump card that I'd been hiding just to make sure I'd win that argument. It was terrible to do that. And she looked at me and she asked me to leave the house. And at the time, it's like, as we were talking earlier, I don't forgive her for what she did, but I'm more understanding, because I'd taken me 4 years at that point to try and accept who I was, and she had 10 minutes. And within those 10 minutes, from me telling her that I was gay and her kicking me out, she hurt, because most mothers, when they have a son, that instant they think of them having a wife and kids and their career path and that kind of stuff. And I ended that for her. So I understand where she came from. I don't agree with what she did.
I was going to say, it's still not okay.
But I, as I've gotten older, I'm more understanding. But
it's interesting you say that, what it was like coming out to your mum, and then to your friends at your party. And my my uncle came out, sadly, not till he was 37, and he left it that long because the community in the area that he lived in, the bubble that he lived in, he just didn't feel comfortable. He didn't think anyone would accept him, so he left it till he was 37, which is, looking back on it, is pretty sad that he had to live. And he looks back, and the fact he had to live so much of that life,
he's trying to get one life, and
exactly
his peak, your 20s and 30s,
exactly. And it would have been so difficult. I wouldn't understand what it would have been like. But when he did come out, and I always like this story, he came out and he first told his mum, so my nana. The way he came out is he went to Melbourne and he went to a Barbara Streisand concert, which even that could have probably been a bit of a giveaway, and then told my nana. But then when he told my dad, his brother, who's his older brother, he built up the courage and he thought, I need to tell Simon here, who's my dad. And he called my dad up and he told him, and my dad was on the phone. He said, Jesus, Pete, he said, I'm so relieved. He said, I'm so relieved. He said, I thought you were going to tell me that you went for Collingwood, who's an AFL side that no one likes Collingwood. So it's just so funny that's my dad. Like, he didn't think twice of, my brother's gay. Yeah. He kind of said, oh, well, it could have been, you could have said you went for Collingwood. Yeah. You're gay. Who cares?
I think that is one of the hardest things about coming out, is that when you come out, especially as a teenager, you think it's all about you, but it affects the lives of people around you, and they've got to learn themselves to accept you. So it's... When you do come out, it's not just your journey. It's a journey for everyone else to accept you. And the more understanding you have of that fact, the easier it will be for you, just because you're not going to go into that from a selfish standpoint. For me, it took me years to get my mum on board. And
you're very empathetic. Do you have a relationship with your mum now?
Oh, indeed. My mum and I are super close. She even goes to gay bingo and brags about me. Like, that's my son. And the drag queen's like, ooh. It took a long time. It took a lot of understanding from both of us that this isn't just my journey, it's our journey. But she's fully accepting now. She looks forward to grandchildren. And
did she apologise for how she responded back then?
Yeah, she definitely has. That's cool. She does try to justify it a little bit, but like I said, it's understanding. coming from different generations, different standpoints.
But you know what? I suppose if she apologises and, you know, and you feel, you know, at peace with that, well, that's probably the main thing. And I think it's, you know, I was speaking about my uncle before when he came out to my papa, his dad. Yeah. The first thing, my papa was very emotional in himself because he actually felt bad over the years that was he a barrier that, my son didn't come out? Was it because of me? And he felt really emotional in himself because he said, did I fail as a father? Did I do something wrong? And then he, you know, they've now got a wonderful relationship, which is amazing. So it's an interesting part of, well, a massive part of your growing up. And I suppose when you were playing sport, you talked about coming out at a party. But what was it like playing rugby and playing sport, you know, as a gay man? Or was there sort of homophobia around? Or how was that being a gay man playing rugby and playing sport?
So as an adult, I got back into rugby at 24. I was a very lost gay man prior to that. I hadn't found my place in the gay community. So I never had really accepted who I was or felt comfortable being gay. And then eventually I ended up joining the Sydney Convicts, which are an inclusive gay rugby team here in Sydney. And I found that a lot of the people in that club had similar or the same experiences that I had. We all grew up playing sport. We all grew up playing rugby or rugby league. And when we came out, we kind of, you're not made to feel welcome. Sport is not a welcoming place for gay men. It's entwined within the culture of sport, unfortunately.
It's just so heartbreaking. Like for me, my mental health is quite dependent on running. It's a massive part of who I am in that community. And I'm imagining if that was taken away from me, I just can't even fathom it. And
when I quit, it was devastating because it's something I'd done since I was four. Like, it's all I'd ever known. Every Saturday in the rugby season was spent playing rugby. I played rugby after school. And
why do you think there is so much homophobia in sport?
I think it's the culture of sport. It's hyper-masculine. And I get that sports like rugby and rugby league, the idea is to go out there and, like, knock people out. Well, better use of a term, but it doesn't mean that being gay doesn't have any effect on that. Like last season, one of my teammates come up to me and the ref had asked him if I was gay because I was tackling so hard. And I looked at my teammate and I was like, what's that got to do with it? Like,
but the fact there's still that, I think that's, you know, no wonder there's that stigma there when the refs are saying things like that. I think that's probably where it is. But growing up with you being such a, you love your rugby, love your sport, you probably didn't have many, if any, gay sport role models that you could look up towards, and that would have probably made it even more difficult for you.
It was tough. The only one that I recall back then was Ian Roberts.
Oh, yeah.
And it's good because I like his style of rugby league, so he just went out and belted people. But
Was he the only one that you could think of?
He's the only one since, I believe, in rugby league in Australia.
Wow. Did he go on Dancing with the Stars?
He did.
Yes, yeah. I can remember. So
he's a better rugby league player than he is dancing.
So is he the only openly whilst playing? I know Casey Conway, he's obviously since come out, but after his rugby career, I think. Is Ian Roberts the only one? I'm just trying to think. I can't think of any openly gay AFL players
Gareth
either.
Gareth Thomas in rugby union.
Yep.
But that's really all I can think of off the top of my head.
But see, no wonder it's difficult, though, for you and why you gave it up.
Well, that's just it. Is like, it's not that gay men are any worse at sport. It's just because we don't feel welcome, we end up leaving. Like myself, I left sport, and I wish that I could have those 6 years of rugby back. My knees don't. But I do, that I missed out in my early 20s. But it's just, we leave because we don't have anyone to look up to. We constantly experience and see homophobia, so it's not somewhere you would stay anyway.
And, like, for me, that's something I just hadn't even thought of. And I was talking with my best friend who's gay about some of the problems he faced, and that was the first thing he said. He's like, I love my footy, I love sport, but just from a young age, I knew that was never going to be an option for me. And you say it's like there's no difference in, you know, physical capabilities on the pitch. That's
well, that's just it. Like for me, at the moment, I'm like 97 kilos, and 6'1". Like I'm not little. And the only thing that affected me was the fact that I was gay. Physically, we're the same. We have the same abilities. It's just we just leave at a younger age.
So look, with, you know, you talk about that. You know, when you're playing rugby. But this is, you know, it's a mental health podcast. And I think it's important to explore during that time where you said you weren't truly comfortable or at acceptance till you're about 24. So during those years leading up to that, you know, how was that for your mental health? And how did you learn to cope? And what struggles did you face through those, you know, vulnerable years?
For me, it was really tough. When I came out, I moved straight to Sydney. Well, not straight away, but when I left school, I come straight to Sydney. And
so did you quit rugby around this time?
Yes.
So you were about 18?
Yeah, about 18 when I quit. I came straight to Sydney and just, I drank too much, went out too much, tried to find where I had fit. We kind of think that when you come out, you're going to get your gay card and some big wings and like angel wings and just run around Oxford Street
accepted
all the time.
Accepted into a big, but happy gay family.
But it's not like that. So I came up to Sydney and I couldn't find my place. So I kind of, as I mentioned earlier, was just a little lost, just glided through life. And
did you party a lot at that time?
I went to a few clubs.
Went to a few clubs on Oxford Street?
Yeah. Just a few.
And I think that is a common thing that happens when people come out of, you know, all of that inner turmoil for years and not exactly knowing who you are. And part of why, you know, the gay community does have, you know, drug and alcohol, that's a common, you know, is that true?
That well, that's the first gay community you see when you come to Sydney. It's where everybody kind of, like Oxford Street is a street full of clubs and bars. And as a gay guy growing up outside of Sydney, the first place I would go to in Sydney would be Oxford Street. So it's kind of you're automatically flung into that world. So you're kind of there by default.
And it's an irony because, you know, alcohol and drugs are so bad for our mental health.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, as a doctor, I see more lives ruined by alcohol than any other drug. And I just find it interesting that, you know, at a stage when you're struggling with your mental health so much, and, you know, that's not just, I guess, the gay community. Lots of people, when they struggle with their mental health, end up, you know,
it's
going
self-medicating.
Yeah, and an escapism.
When you're drunk, you forget your own issues and you're out having a great time, but it's not until you have to rebound from that and you're in your own thoughts that the issues really show their head.
When you say that, in your own thoughts, you know, describe what's that's like when you say in your own thoughts and, you know, you're struggling to accept yourself.
As much as I say I accept myself now, there's some part of it that still struggles. With gay men, we need to realise that we have to live with the fact that not everyone likes us. People are always going to discriminate against us regardless of what we do. So that, as a teenager and in your early 20s, is a heavy burden to bear. And that's kind of what I meant by, like, your own thoughts is that's what you're stuck with having to live with until you can fully accept who you are.
Yeah, and it's understandable, you know, what the area that you're in your life, and, you know, you couldn't be playing sport, which you loved, but then so you did then move to Canada. And was that partly to get out of, you know, that Australia bubble and just go somewhere else, or how did that come about?
Yeah, so I had gotten back into sport. I ended up playing two seasons with the Sydney Convicts, and I was like, oh shit, this is what I love doing. I kind of felt whole and content, ironically doing what I'd always done. I'd done a full 360 and come back to the start. So I ended up moving to Canada to play rugby there with a local team called the Calgary Canucks. And this wasn't an inclusive team or anything. There were other gay players in that league and everything. So it shows how much more accepting it is there. I ended up playing only two games for them before I took up training for bobsleigh.
Yeah. Now tell us bobsleigh. This is the interesting part of the journey. We've gone kind of through your upbringing, your passion for sport, coming out as a gay man, the struggles you sort of faced in that acceptance, spent many years not playing sport. Like you said, 360, went back to sport, played for the Convicts, found that passion again, moved to Canada, got back into rugby, and then all of a sudden you found yourself bobsledding. How did that come about?
It took a lot of training. I'll put that out there. So basically the first game, because I'm an aggressive player, I got red carded first 2 minutes. The team thought I was a shit. They hated me. So the second game, I knew that I had to really make up for it. And within 10 minutes, I'd scored 3 tries. But obviously, fitness isn't my forte, so I didn't do much after that. And then after the game, I had a guy come up to me and goes, you're really fast and strong. Have you ever thought about training for this? And that guy ended up being Heath Spence, who was the pilot at Sochi, the Olympics there. And that's basically, because I worked at the Winter Sports Institute as well, so I started to train for bobsleigh, and then I ended up getting the chance to try out. So I was back here for a rugby tournament, and I had to fly back to Canada to push things down hills, and made the development team for Australia.
I love it. And had you heard of bobsledding before you got approached?
Yeah, I've watched the movie.
I was going to say, you've watched Cool Running.
I worked at the Winter Sports Institute, so I'd seen it. The bobsleigh track was just outside. But I'd never had really too much information or experience of it.
And so you were training for the Australian team in Canada?
Yes. So once I had the opportunity to be recruited, I ended up spending it was about 8 months just consistently training, working full time before I tried out.
What work did you do just for interest?
I worked at a gym, so it made it easy.
It's interesting. I look at bobsledding. And when I love watching it in the Winter Olympics and stuff like that, I look at it as it seems dangerous. Like you jump in this, like how quick do you go on those things?
So the fastest I had gotten up to was 151 kilometres an hour at Whistler. And at that speed down the bottom of the track, you're like, if we tip here, we're like, it's going to hurt.
Do they ever tip?
Yeah, definitely.
Did you tip and ever get injured?
Yeah, so... weirdly enough, rugby.
You went from rugby where you get your head banged over and over to now do an even more dangerous
150
sport.
Kilometres in a buddy.
you very rarely get injured in bobsleigh. It's controlled danger. Yeah. You do tip over and basically if you avoid hitting your head on anything, you get an ice burn because your skin is then on the ice. But during my time, it was just a few ice burns and a few bruises because when you tap a wall at 150 kilometres an hour, it's quite the tap.
A lot of energy.
It's not a tap, it's a smack. But then when I got back into rugby, it's funny because people always tell me how dangerous bobsleigh is. I was like, in the last 2 years, I've separated, dislocated my shoulder, tore my bicep from the tendon. Oof. I've been knocked out like 4 times, compressed a disc in my spine. And you're like, maybe bobsleigh was the better option.
So how many years did you have your bobsledding journey for?
So I began training in 2013-14, and then I ended up quitting or retiring, for better use of a term, in 2017.
And one question, how was the reaction to being a gay athlete in the bobsled world? I knew you were the first ever openly gay athlete to represent a country in bobsledding.
It was tough. Before I even went into the tryouts, I messaged my teammates to be like, just so you know, I'm gay. I wasn't willing to go through what I did as a teenager where my sexuality was an issue with sport. I wanted to be upfront about it. I wanted to be honest and just to save myself the trauma that I'd already been through. They were fine with it. Unknowingly, the president of the federation made some jokes at tryouts about it, not realizing that I was gay. And just look on my teammates' face with that. But...
So what joke did he make?
I was something a bit about just something really mature and just petty that comes with sporting environments. And it was just like, it was a water off a duck's back. It didn't bother me. I was like...
And did you get much or any backlash? You said you messaged your teammates. They were fine with it.
Teammates were fine. You heard stories from people. There was an article written in Russia about me and about me ruining the sport because it's a man's sport.
In Russian?
Yeah. I actually, one of my best friends, she was Russian and I got her to read it to me and she wouldn't read it to me. She was
so you
like,
still don't know what it said?
I know what it said because I eventually got it out of it. She was like tearing up reading it.
What did it say, if you don't mind?
Just basically about me being gay and that bobsleigh's a man's sport and that I'm ruining it. And
you're ruining
just by being
sport
gay.
Because you're gay.
How did that feel for you, you know, knowing that those things were being said about you?
It's tough because it's being... You worry about what you're not seeing or hearing, the whispers from people. But at that stage, thankfully, I was in a better position than I was as a 16-year-old.
I just can't believe that. You know, I'm just trying to. It's difficult, but put myself in your shoes. You know, you're a talented athlete. You know, you're fit. You spend so much hard work training. You're trying out for, you know, trying to represent your country, and then you see these or read these things saying that. Because of your sexuality, you're ruining the sport of bobsledding. It's just like, I get that you can have thick skin and you can kind of, you know, not let it affect you, but surely you read that type of stuff and go like, far out. Like, you know, what
I think the first reaction, me being me, was I was just happy there was an article in Russia about me. I see the silver lining here.
I like it.
Someone's in Russia's writing
no
about me.
No bad press is, yeah. No, is it? No
press is bad press.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I wasn't complaining. But they do get to you. It's similar to comments on Facebook or articles and stuff. You do read them. You see what people say about you. And as much as you pretend you don't take it on, you definitely take it on, regardless of who you are. I guarantee there's some A-list celebrities out there reading comments people write. And I think we forget that because we're on social media and we're behind our computer. We don't think it affects them, but it does have an effect on people.
And we've actually spoke about this previously, you know, I think with Braith, one of our guests, about we're all human beings. And I think, you know, whether you're a gay man or not, a lot of these, you know, public figures or athletes, and you know, that's their job, that's their passion. They get this ridicule and online sort of trolling, and people often don't realise that behind all that uniform, behind all of that, you're just a normal human being.
Yeah, we're just regular people. Some of the stuff we do or some of the things we say, you might not agree with, but it doesn't mean you have an inherent right to put me down because you might be upset with yourself or you just think.
And that's exactly it. It's not about, you know, when people are trolling, it's not about the person. It's about the person behind the keyboard and their traumas and their issues, and that to make them. And this is, you know, in real, you know, normal life or when it's behind a keyboard. Most people being, you know, aggressive assholes, it's a projection of their own trauma, and that they don't realize, you know, their internalized issues that they don't even consciously recognize. And that's, you know, so much about where, you know, homophobia and racism comes from. It's, you know, finding scapegoats for people's anger and trauma that they don't know how to deal with.
They need to portray onto someone else. Mm.
And so we will mention the word. I know you said you don't often like the O word.
But the naughty O word.
But we
everyone is like, what's the O word?
Said it at the start and people are like, what is the O word about?
You know, you had this obviously goal, this dream, and naturally so you're working your way up to the Olympics. You narrowly missed out on representing Australia in the Olympics. What was that like, I suppose, when you didn't quite make that, and did it ruin your hopes and dreams? How did you handle all of that?
At the time, it didn't seem like an issue. I was like, I can accept this. I've managed to represent Australia. I'm now moving to London. But when the Olympics were on, I couldn't watch them. And I still have moments now where I look back and be like, fuck, if I had done that. It was an opportunity to represent my community and Australia on a much larger level. And I still question what more I could have done if I had actually been able to do that.
And the fact that you still question that now, like, how do you, I guess, deal with those what ifs and what could have been? Because we all have them in life of, you know, moments in time that could have had such a big change to the rest of our life.
It's a tough one. Like, it's still something that, as I mentioned, I struggle with. My partner's the same. He was trying for the Olympics in long jump and he missed out as well. So we have that common
Shared commiseration together.
So that's why the O word's banned in our house.
When you have kids, you'll have like an alphabet and there'll be all the letters, and then it'll just go like M, N, what's after P? No, L, M, N, O, P. Yes, skip the O.
Our child will be forced to go forced into sports. So, I don't know. It's a tough one. I don't think I have fully dealt with it, and I'd still have loved the opportunity, but I try and do a lot more other things for the community, so with charities and that kind of stuff, so that I know that the goals and the journey that I've been on are still going in the right direction.
Yeah, and I think it's probably a good time then to kind of, you know, moving past that, you know, your bobsledding journey, and you're, you know, living over in Canada, representing your country. And you know, what was your, I guess, life after sports? You mentioned before, you're 33. So life after sport, you met your now partner, Felix. Mm-hmm. You know, you're living back in Australia. What was that like, I guess, accepting in a way that, probably my Olympic days or my Olympic dreams are probably over now?
Yep.
You moved back to Australia. What was your life after
sports? Originally I moved to London. That's where I met Felix because he played for the same rugby team. It was exciting because I was in London. And I think that's why I had the big crash when I moved home here mentally. But it's just exciting to be in London. That's when I started to do charity work a lot for the LGBTQI community, because that community were my advocates when I was competing. They were my biggest champions, so I want to give back to them. It might not surprise you, Australian bobsledders don't earn much money.
What? Never.
So I'm not one of those athletes who can just write a check and donate to these charities. So I try and put my voice behind them, or just even go and volunteer in my own time to just kind of give back to them.
And you mentioned that just before, you kind of that whole when your mental health spiraled. There was a post that I saw, and it was quite a powerful post of you with a beer in hand, probably not in your best shape, and you've always been in phenomenal shape, and you decided that you wanted to open up. And you're at a, you know, interesting crossroads in your life and where you were. And do you just want to talk about?
So that post was, it's just after I came back to Australia. So I'd left London. I'd been there for nearly 2 years, and I came back to Australia and You got a picture of my life when I was bobsledding. I was representing Australia. I was traveling the world, doing all these fun things. Then I moved to London, and I was doing my work there, charity work, going to events and that kind of stuff. And then I found myself sleeping on my mum's couch in Goulburn. I spoke to a doctor about it. It's called an adjustment disorder. So basically, you're probably better explaining this, but you start to, you don't adapt to changes as well as you think you would. And then you show signs of stress, anxiety, and depression. So I went through that probably for a good few months trying to just get used to being back here. And the doctor, the way he was like, he goes, I don't want to put you on medication because it's about adjusting. And he goes, do you know what you need to do? He goes, you need to go back to the gym. Because at that stage, I hadn't gotten back into the gym because I physically didn't want to get up in the morning. I was like, I'm in Goulburn. Like, what else am I going to do?
So just for us to get our heads around, you know, why you did come back and this journey and that you're seeing a doctor, you're seeing a GP for your mental health, which is great. Can you tell us why you did come back to Australia?
So my visa expired. Probably the easiest way. And I was over 30, so it was harder for me to get a visa. It was during Brexit, even harder to get a visa. And then my partner was going to Singapore to work, so I was due to come home.
And so what symptoms were you saying you were very stressed and not wanting to go to the gym? Can you, just for our listeners to get a picture, can you tell us how you were feeling and how you knew something was wrong?
So for me, it was just I had lost a zest for life. Like, I'm always someone who's super positive, wanting to do stuff. It would take me forever to get up in the morning. My anxiety would go through the roof for no reason.
What was that like?
It was weird because it's something I've never had.
What type of things would make you anxious?
Having money. Like, I had to ask my mum for money, so that would stress me out. And I was like, I'm 32, and I'm like, Mum, can I borrow $10 for lunch? Missing the train would stress me out. Just little things that would normally you would just ignore or brush off would cause me to stress out.
And that's a common symptom of, you know, burnout is our stress trigger is much more sensitive. And, you know, when we have burnout and chronic stress, the part of our brain that regulates emotion, it's called the amygdala. We see in studies of people who are chronically stressed, it's swollen, it's more sensitive. So, you know, people might be hard on themselves of, you know, why am I getting so upset by this little thing? But, you know, people's brains actually change in chronic stress. And, you know, that's such a warning sign that if you're not being able to deal with, you know, if you're crying because you missed the train or, you know, you dropped something on the floor, you know, that's not normal and there's something causing that. And for you, it sounds like you recognise that something wasn't right. Can you tell us what made you see your GP and how you knew seeing your GP was a good step to go for your mental health?
I think it's because I just felt so low. I knew something was wrong. There was even a time where, because I trained at Anytime Fitness, so I would make sure nobody was at the gym when I trained. And remember, I've worked in gyms and been in gyms since I was 13. And the fact that it got to the point where I didn't want to be around anybody, even in the gym.
Is that a body image thing or just didn't want to be around people?
Didn't want to be around people. And it got to the point where I was like, this isn't right. I need to fix this. I was crying at nighttime. Didn't want to talk to my partner on the phone or anything.
So you were withdrawing yourself socially.
Yeah. And then so that's when I was like, I need to go talk to a doctor. And it was kind of, I didn't intentionally go to the doctor for it. I went to the doctor for a checkup. And then at the end when the doctor was like, is there anything else I can help you with? And I was like, oh. I think deep down I knew that's probably why I actually went there subconsciously, but I ended up.
And the doctor could probably pick up on that. And it sounds like they're a pretty good doctor that at the end they said, and that's what we're often trained to do with patients is, maybe they're not ready if we ask them directly, but there's like, you know, is there anything else that's been going on?
But it's probably also an important point to raise there. It obviously is you're a doctor, and is it people can go to a doctor or a GP for their mental health, you know, and that's something that probably still needs to be better understood. Is it absolutely a doctor or a GP can be a great first step? And, you know, you didn't deliberately go there for that reason initially, but it kind of came out, and that was probably one of the reasons that you started talking about it and started.
I think the biggest thing for me was he didn't give me medication or anything. He just gave me, it was the acknowledgement that he goes, yeah, this is a thing. You're not weird. There's nothing wrong with you. It's just you're struggling to adjust with your new circumstances, We need to start putting steps into place to get you back to where you were.
And that's like, we know we've talked about that with Gus Warland and other people about not worrying alone. Even just the weight lifted off your shoulders of sharing with someone how you're feeling and the validation that, you know, you've got reasons to be feeling like this. There's not anything wrong with you. And in terms of what an adjustment disorder is, as you said, it's adjusting to a new set of circumstances. So for some people, that might be the loss of a job, a loss of a relationship, you know, grieving someone. And it's not, it might present very similarly to depression in that you're losing motivation, you're socially withdrawing, people might gain weight. But it's not, you know, clinical depression because it's from an acute episode. And, you know, for anyone who's living in Melbourne at the moment that's just been in COVID, that's what a lot of people are going through. It's an acute adjustment. And it's, you know, recognizing that that's what's happening. There's a reason why you're feeling like this. And it sounded like for you, getting some more structure and routine back in your life was important part of...
Yeah, indeed. I think for me, going to the gym properly, I was in Goulburn, so I had nothing else to do, so I went twice a day. Started looking for like gyms to train out of in Sydney and just kind of setting goals and having a clear direction, which is what I didn't have when I came back because I didn't know what I was doing.
A bit of structure.
Yeah.
And did you notice that when your mood was starting to improve and your mental health was starting to improve, and did you notice that in yourself thinking, oh, hang on, I don't have to always feel like I was just feeling like...
Yeah, indeed. It took a couple of weeks to kind of get through the, like, dragging myself out of bed and dragging myself to the gym and kind of doing what I needed to do to set my life back up again as a 32-year-old, which, like, not many 32-year-olds have retired and then having to redo things.
And it's an important issue is talking about, like, I talk about this post-sport syndrome. So many elite athletes go through this, whether they're, you know, gay or straight or anything else going on in their life. And I really don't think athletes are looked after very well after their careers. I know, sorry, we're going on a different topic.
Well, they end a lot earlier than most people's careers, whereas most people who retire are 60 or 70, so that's when they have to deal with it. I'm fortunate the fact that I was only in training for bobsleigh for 4 years full time. But these poor athletes that start sport at 10, they retire when they're 30. It must be a lot harder for them.
And what other things? I think it's just while we're, you know, talking about this before we start to talk about some of the you know, the amazing work you're doing now for some of your ambassadorial work for charities. But what are some of the other things? You said you had a bit of structure going to the gym, but were there any other things you were doing to look after your mental health?
That helped a lot, just working on moving back to Sydney out of my mum's like spare room. And even now, I still have the occasional anxiety episode, which these are things that didn't happen until I moved back. And now that I have a better understanding on what they are, I'm in a better position to, either if I'm too anxious one day, I'll just take myself away and deal with it, or put myself in a position where I can actually help myself rather than thinking something's wrong.
Have you ever seen a psychologist for, you know, helping with anxiety or?
No, just my doctor.
Oh, pretty good doctor.
He suggested it, but it was based on the fact that, see how I go.
It's great to see, you know, the work you're doing now. We've obviously only met you today, but you do seem like a very bubbly, positive, passionate guy, which is awesome. But that, just very quickly, I wanted to touch on that image we spoke about, that social media post. Just for people listening, and I do like to repeat it, we have spoken about it in previous episodes, but the whole life on social media, and this is called Behind the Uniform, and quite often you'd scroll through your social media Instagram page and you're a, you know, great looking guy, very ripped, you know, you look like you're living the perfect life.
Stop
but then yes, which, you know, but then you spoke about during the coffee that you would often find old photos to post when you were struggling at your mum's on the couch and you felt you had to post those photos until you thought, no, you know what, people need to realise that sometimes there's stuff that goes on behind this uniform.
Well, that's just social media. We put out the image we want people to see. And for me, like, I'm so grateful for the last 6 years of my life. They've been amazing. I'm not crying victim at all. I'm so blessed to have been able to travel the world, represent Australia, live in London. But regardless, like, as you mentioned before, you have the friends who have everything and they're miserable. The life we show the world is what we want the world to see. So at that time, I would go through old photo shoot photos or like old photos of me at the beach and be like, oh, having a great time. When deep down, I was sitting on my mum's couch, miserable, drinking beer. And when that photo, when I found that photo, I was like, this is at the peak, because I put on about 10 kilos of like what at the time was fat, because I wasn't doing anything. And that's when I posted that photo, and I was like, it wasn't about putting on the weight, it was about how I actually felt inside, and just how I felt and looked was a reflection of the
place I was in. It's not about the weight, it's what's led to
you
know, you sitting on the couch and drinking the beers.
Yeah, it was the place I was in mentally and how low I felt, that whereas the week before I'd been posting photo shoot photos. So.
It's interesting as well that perception you're giving of something that you weren't, and I can't help but identify of the times when you hadn't come out as being gay and you're putting on this persona of, you know, not being gay, and, you know, 10, 15 years later, that it would have been almost a bit triggering of putting on this front of, you know, photo shoot photos and having this happy, great life when you were actually feeling pretty miserable. Like, it's...
Well, that's just it. So for me, when I was an athlete, I prided myself on being upfront and honest about my life. Like, I've talked about everything from, like, sexual partners to HIV to scares and tests and, like, stuff that generally you don't publicly share with the world. And then all of a sudden I found myself hiding behind that veil again and... not actually being as upfront and honest as that I prided myself on being only 6 months earlier.
Mm. No, it's and it's yeah, and that's obviously one of the themes of this podcast, and it's powerful to hear you say that. It's great that you are now such a strong advocate for these things. You mentioned the HIV before, and you are a proud ambassador for the Bobby Goldsmith Foundation. Yep. And before we start to sort of, you know, wrap up this episode, I think it's important to talk about, you know, what the amazing work you do, or the amazing charity work, and the stuff that you do for the Bobby Goldsmith Foundation.
Indeed. So Bobby Goldsmith is one of the charities that I've become an ambassador for and do volunteer work and promotional stuff with them. I started in London with Terence Higgins Trust. And I think for me, it's trying to break down the stigma associated with HIV/AIDS, because the gay community, we ourselves still... are judgy and have that stigma that shouldn't be there when this is our own community. So I try to give back by putting my face and being honest and chatting about those kind of things.
No, I love it. I love it. I think it's important. I think it's that changing that stigma. And I think for people interested, and they can find out more about the Bobby Goldsmith Foundation, I think it's on your Instagram.
Instagram Bobby Goldsmith and Give Out Day, I'm an ambassador for. But definitely look into it. They're doing amazing work. Like, 2 weeks ago, I went out and did a client visit, and it's the most humbling thing to do with your own struggles is going out and meeting their clients who are going through.
So they support people in the community with HIV.
Yeah, so they support people living with HIV on all different levels. So things from help with rent, help take them shopping.
Love it.
Last week, we just went around for a social visit and to check on the guy. And it was an amazing experience, and it's something that, like, I take 2 days off a week to do these things for charity. So
that's awesome. That's you should be proud for that, mate. A lot of people don't realise a lot goes into putting your time aside for that charity, and the fact you put your time into it and you're passionate about it, which is awesome. And for people to find that, obviously at By Simon Dunn is your Instagram handle. By Simon Dunn, and then they can find that in your bio. I must admit, I had a look before and was just going through some of their posts, and I was actually learning so much about it. It's awesome to see. So look, and I think it's also. Oh, before we wrap up, I just want to talk about your 2021 upcoming calendar that you're launching.
Yes, that calendar.
Because I mentioned it to my uncle, who's gay, and he said, Simon Dunn, he's like, that name rings a bell. And he was scrolling through your Instagram, and he thought, gee, whiz, he's a good-looking buddy.
I can definitely organise a signed calendar for him.
Oh, there you go. I'm sure he'll be your biggest fan.
Well, can do that.
So the 2021 calendar. For those that want to see a great-looking guy on their fridge for next year.
Especially if you like tattoos.
Yeah.
So what is the story behind the two tiger tattoos?
So this is a bragging story, but I got them for free. And so this is back in 2015. A tattooist in Arizona was like, I'll give you some tattoos. And I really like them. There's no meaning. I just like them. And back then, Attitude Magazine voted me the world's hottest man. But I'd organized a trip to Arizona. And they're like, we need you to come. So they flew me on one weekend. I went from Calgary to London, had one party there. They flew me from London to Arizona, and I was back to work by Monday.
I wish I'd known about the world's hottest man. I would have included them in the bio in the introduction, Simon.
I'm still raining, so I think they like, they're like, oh, this doesn't work.
We've got it at the end of the episode, so now maybe our title can be World's Hottest Man. That's going to get a few people keen.
Raining
World's Hottest Man. So now that's awesome. And we'll do a little bit of a behind the uniform giveaway of the 2021 Dunn calendar, which can be personally signed.
Actually, Movember fundraising, I'm looking for prizes.
We can definitely do that.
Let's do that. No, looking forward to it. And I'll be getting a copy myself, Simon.
So, for the fridge.
For the fridge. And look, just before, the final thing we like to do actually as well is the, we call it the Behind the Uniform Challenge. And we, you know, you've spoken about some great things in the last hour or so, but we like our guests to sort of set us a bit of a challenge, a weekly challenge. And then hopefully those listening can listen to what you're about to set us and set them and try doing it for that week. So just to finish off, is there a little challenge or something that you can set us for
I think obviously COVID dependent. At the moment, I think get outside. We all live in the hustle and bustle of cities generally.
Especially Sydney.
Go outside for an hour and just breathe. Look at the air, look at the sky. Just listen to the birds and just kind of center yourself.
So let's make that tangible. So something that people can do, I think every day, there's nothing far-fetched. It doesn't have to be for 2 hours, but every day to just put that little bit of time aside to go outside. Doesn't have to be a run.
For no specific purpose, just go outside.
Go outside, fresh air, look at nature. I like
it. Can I add in as well, leave the phone at home?
Oh, yes, definitely.
We are connected to and that's a part of the reason I love swimming, because you can't have your phone, you can't be doing anything else, you know, you're in the water. And so maybe we could add on to this go outside challenge, leave your phone at home.
I'm definitely an advocate for that one there.
Well, there you go. We've just kind of merged a bit of a Simon Dunn challenge, but let's do it the whole find time every day. Could be 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour to go outside, go into nature, get some fresh air and leave the phone at home. I like that. I like it. Is you kind of blend it in a.
Sorry, I hope I'm not breaking behind the uniform laws.
No, I'm very happy with that suggestion.
No, I love it. So look, Simon. Look, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
For sharing your story, for opening up about, you know, the some of the struggles that you've gone through, but also some of the amazing accomplishments you know you've done, and you know your rugby career and your bobsledding career, and then also the work now you do for you know foundations and for the whole LGBTQI community. And you should be a proud role model. And I know we're super honoured to have you here today. And also the world's hottest man. I'm pretty stoked to be sitting opposite you.
2015 though, I've aged a little bit. But thank you very much for having me. It's really been a pleasure.
And I'm so excited to see where your journey goes. I feel like in some ways it's just the beginning, and there's going to be some really great, you're going to do some really great things for the world. So I'm really honoured to meet you today and keep following your journey.
Thank you.
No worries. And then for those who do want to follow Simon's journey, it's at by Simon Dunn, and you can definitely get inspired and motivated with your amazingly ripped body. look at me.
Or enter my Movember raffle and you might even be able to win a calendar.
Yeah, we'll throw a few your way. So
perfect. Thanks Simon.
So much,
really appreciate
Simon.
It, mate.
Thank you for having me.